Accession number 205781, Reel 1.
Tony Adams, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
In the village of East Horsley, in Surrey.
Which year was this?
1917.
Did both your mother and father come from East Horsley?
No, my mother and father immediately came from Dulwich. My father's family for many years had been tailors in the City of London. There was a shop in Cheapside bearing our name. My mother comes from Cumberland, where all the family on her side are farmers, even today.
What did your father do for a living when you were growing up?
Yeah, my father had a factory in the City Road in London where they made pattern books for high-quality tailors, bunches they were known as.
Did you grow up and have your schooling at East Horsley?
No, I started at Guildford High School for girls until I was 9, and then I went to Abingdon, and I was there. I went in January 1927, and I left in July 1934.
Did you get a job on leaving?
No, I went on to college. I got a scholarship. A Surrey County Council provided one scholar per year at Y College in Kent, the agricultural college, and I was there from October 1934, until July 1937.
Why did you decide to go in for agriculture?
I was lucky. From the very early days, East Horsley was then largely a farming village, and I always played about on the farms, and I always wanted to farm. I was the only son, and my father was very generous, and he had hoped that I would go in his business. But when he could see that I wanted to farm, then he said, right, you must go to college, and that was how it was. I've always wanted to farm. Yeah.
And on leaving Y College in 37, what happened then?
The first problem was to find a job. I'd done quite well at college. I was the top student of my year and got a handful of prizes, but jobs were very, very hard to come by. And eventually I got a job in a village called Thurley in North Bedfordshire. This would be in November 1937. And I worked on this farm. The rank, if you like, was called improver. And I did the jobs that the farmer daren't ask any of his other men to do. I think I had all the dirty jobs to do. And there I worked on this farm, but all jobs.
What kind of thing?
Milking the cows, looking after the sheep, arable work, driving the tractor, working the horses, any job that was going, I would do.
What was farming like in the late 30s?
Farming was desperate. It was in a worse state than it is today. Prices were appalling. On many occasions, my boss couldn't pay my week's wages, which were only 25 shillings or thereabouts. He simply hadn't got the cash, and he would lend me his car, and I would go down into the town of Bedford with half hundredweights of potatoes, hawking them round the street to get my money. And one particular field of his, he didn't cultivate, it was just growing bushes, because he said he lost less money leaving it like that than farming it. Mm-hmm. Yes, today you hear about the difficulties, the very real difficulties we have on the farm, but there is nothing compared with the difficulties in those days.
So it was all down to price levels?
Price levels. You see, what had happened after the First World War, there was great demand for food. Farmers were encouraged to grow food, and then the support was pulled away and they were just left. You see, it absolutely collapsed, yes. As an indication, the farm I worked on was 180 acres, and I could have bought the farm for £3,000 in those days.
What was the name of that farm?
That was called Hall End Farm in Thurley in Bedfordshire.
Was the farming in Bedfordshire much different from other places?
It varied. In parts of Bedfordshire, it's market gardening. It was, in those days, even more so than today. That was in the sandy ground in the south of the county, but the north of the county is very heavy clay. It's altered now because the hedges have all been pulled out, the cattle have disappeared, and it's virtually prairie farming with corn now.
Did you join TA before the war?
Yes. How it came about was when I was on this farm at Thurlow in the autumn of 1938, Chamberlain came back from Munich with his bit of paper saying it'd be peace in our time. I've always been a bit cynical, and I thought, well, you know, that's almost certain to mean war. I'd better join the TA. I'd been in the OTC at school, and I got my Certificate A. The Certificate A, it meant that I could fire a Lewis gun and do rifle drill and exercise a platoon in sort of basic movement. And it said that in the event of war, you'd be considered for a commission. But I couldn't, it wasn't possible to join the TA at that time. Interestingly, we had a searchlight came from Leicester with territorials on the farm. But later in the spring of 1939, I'd moved. I got the sack from this job, and I got another job in the south of the county of Bedfordshire. And in April 39, it was decided to double the number in the Territorial Army. So I wrote to the adjutant of the Bedfordshire Yeomanry saying that I'd got my cert A and I would like to join and were there any officer vacancies. And he wrote back saying no, there were no vacancies, but if I wanted to join, I could join as another rank at Biggleswade, which I did. And in due course, I reported to the drill hall in Biggleswade. I was interviewed by the battery commander and the battery sergeant major, and they put me into the specialist section. The Bedfordshire Yeomanry consisted of headquarters and 417. It was the 105 Field Regiment. Bedfordshire Yeomanry was headquarters and 417 battery in Bedford, 418 battery at Biggleswade, 419 and 420 batteries in Dunstable and Leighton Buzzard. Interesting thing happened when I arrived there. The sergeant major was very keen that I should join the guards, and he explained that if he could get people to volunteer for the guards, he would be paid so much an inch for their height over 5'10". I was then 6'4", and I was worth 30 shillings to him. I declined the invitation and signed up at Biggleswade. They explained to me that there was no pay. We parade on Tuesdays and Thursdays and Sunday mornings. But I did get paid because I lived in a village called Campton, which was 7 miles away. I got threepence per time for cycling money, so that added to the income. I was put in the specialist section. They were the technicians, I suppose you'd call them today. And I was actually a gun position officer's assistant, GPO AC. And it was my job to, when the officer in the observation post sent down the map reference of a target, I had to work out the line, range, and angle of sight to the target, and pass it to the gun position officer, who shouted it to the guns, who banged off it, hopefully, and got something to the target. It was a technical job, which I enjoyed. In July 1939, we went to camp at Shoreham. It was a holiday camp. The TA in those days, 1 year went to firing camp, one time to holiday camp. And this was a year for holiday camp, and nothing much happened there. I was on my own in one respect. They couldn't fit me with a uniform. We were short of guns, short of airplanes, short of everything, so I paraded in civilian clothes. On the 1st of September 1939, my boss came into the field. We were actually carting beans, I can remember very clearly. Came into the field and said to me, "Go on, you've got to go to the drill hall. The TA is being called up." And to this day, I can remember sticking my pitchfork in the ground and walking off. And a man in the village of Campton gave me a lift to the drill hall, and I reported in there on the Friday afternoon. Again, I've no uniform. We listened to the broadcast on the Sunday morning saying that war had been declared, and immediately the air raid warning sounded. It was decided that we would have to have some local anti-aircraft defence on the drill hall. And so up went a Lewis gunner and his assistant who would put the magazines on. And they thought, well, it's a bit exposed up there. We'll have to put a sandbag ring round the gun. So they picked up a block and tackle and a few pulleys and things. And we spent the time hauling up sandbags and built this wall. And we got on well until the roof collapsed under the weight of it and it all fell through into the drill hole. So that was the end of the anti-aircraft defence of Biggleswade drill hole. But that was the just sort of one of the silly things that happened. In November 1939, suddenly we turned in our guns, 4-5 howitzers and 18-pounders, and we were issued with 9-2 howitzers, colossal great big guns that had been used in the First World War. They were made in 1917, designed to fire big shells for destroying concrete emplacements, blockhouses, and this sort of thing. Very big guns. They travelled in three bits on the road, and in the First World War, they'd been pulled by steam traction engines, such as you see at a fairground today. We hadn't got these things, so we had AEC Matadors to pull them. The guns travelled in three bits, on trailers, big things to me like timber bobs, big steel frame things, but with wooden wheels with iron tires. And the first trailer carried three girders, about 20, 22 feet long, box girders about 2 feet square. These had to be bedded in the ground before the gun could be fired. The gunners had to dig trenches to accept these. We didn't have JCBs. The second one carried the carriage, which was the main body of the gun, which was pulled into place and dropped onto these girders. And the third one carried the actual barrel of the gun, which was pushed into the carriage, and the gun was ready to fire. And then on the front of the gun, you put in a big box, galvanized iron box, into which you put the earth that you dug out for these trenches. Because if you didn't, when the gun... It held about 20 tons of earth from memory. When the gun was fired, if you didn't have this box full of earth, it would have tipped over on its back on the recoil. So it took 8 hours to get into action, however hard the men tried. We were limited to 4 miles an hour speed on the road because, as I said, they got iron tires and wooden wheels. And we exercised with these things round. We never put them into action or pretended to go into action. We exercised with them on the road. And then in just before Christmas, we moved down to Thornbury near Bristol, and we were there for some months. We did move from Thornbury to Lark Hill, the home of the artillery, to fire these guns. I was still GPOAC, and I'd got additional jobs to do now because these guns fire a very big shell in a very long way, and besides line range and angle of sight, I had to make allowance for the barometric pressure, because if the barometer's high, the shell doesn't travel so well as if the pressure's low. For the temperature of the air, because a shell travels better through hot air than cold air. And also make allowances for the charge temperature, because if the charge, which makes the shell go off, is hot, you get a better bang. And, of course, you get wind direction effect on it. So there am I armed with log tables and a slide rule and work out all these things. And we got the gun in action. And the colonel's son, the colonel was Colonel Comerford, his son Eric, had the privilege of firing the first gun, first round, because we literally didn't know what would happen, whether the thing would blow up, tip over backwards, what it was. And we banged off. And... most effective. The shell landed pretty close to the target. The colonel got complimented, and I had done all the work, and I had no thanks at all for it, but that's the army all along. In end of March, we moved out of Thornbury to go to France, and I can't remember where we left or where we went or where we landed in France, but I remember meeting these French wagons, 8 horses or 40 men, and we were loaded in these things and set off eastward. And eventually we arrived at a village called Fleurbaix. Fleurbaix is a mile or two from Armentières, quite close to the Belgian border. And there we were billeted in a farmhouse. Battery headquarters, of which I was part, the officers lived in the farmhouse with Monsieur and Madame Pêche Bataille, their name was, and the soldiers, the specialists, signalers, and people like myself lived in the loft over the hay. I enjoyed that phase because the ground was very, very hard frozen still. It was a bitterly cold spring. And I used to spend most of my time exercising the farm horses with the farmer's son by riding them up and down the road simply to give the horses exercise because there was no farm work. It was interesting there because Fleurbay had been fought over in the First World War, and in the evening when the sun was low, you could see the line of the trenches and all the debris from battle, you know, cartridge cases, cap badges and so on. I had a very good friend, Bob Gunn, and we were only 3 or 4 miles from the Belgian border, and we'd read in the paper about this Maginot line that stretched from the Switzerland to the sea, so we thought we were going to have a look at this. And so we walked to the Belgian border, not a sign, nothing whatever there, not a trench, not a bit of barbed wire. We were a bit taken aback, and I asked one of the officers why this was, and he said, well, it was a political thing. They didn't want to offend the Belgians. And it rather alarmed me when I realized there was absolutely nothing between us and Belgium. And all went well until, I think it was about the 10th of May. I was on guard at the time. I was at about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was leaning against these barn doors on this farm. There was all of a sudden, there was this awful loud bang, and the barn doors hit me in the back. I wondered what this was. And then the next thing was we could hear aircraft flying overhead and searchlights lit up and anti-aircraft fire went up. And I thought, God, the balloon's gone up now. And that was the end of our peaceful bit. And next day we, the battery headquarters set off eastward. We crossed the into Belgium at a place called Quesnoy. And the guns followed us at 4 miles an hour. We could move more quickly in our lorries. And we went belting up into Belgium. I don't know how far we got, I forget now, but we somewhere up near Tournai, I think, we were still moving eastward. And we could hear the sounds of battle pretty close. And then the order came to withdraw. On the way into Belgium, I experienced the problem of refugees coming streaming out of Belgium. You see, many of them could remember only too clearly the German occupation of the First World War, and all they were intent on was heading westward as hard as they could go. And they took no notice of traffic regulations. They simply streamed all over the road in carts, hearses, fire engines, anything that would carry people streaming along. And it was a disturbing sight. I had no weapon. Not a pistol, not anything. I bitterly regretted it one day because a thing called a Fiesler Storch, that's a little monoplane, a little German observation monoplane, flew over at tree height. It would have been a lovely shot with a rifle, but I had nothing. I could do nothing. And then we turned around and retreated westward because we had heard, we used to put the wireless sets onto the BBC in the evening, and we'd heard that the Germans had broken through to the south of us and had actually reached the sea at Abbeville. And by looking at the map, I realized that we were totally bottled up. I should say by now, I have got a uniform. When we were at Thornbury, in the days just before we were due to go abroad, it was realized that I was still in civilian clothes. And had I gone to war like that, I would have been a francs-tireur and liable to be shot if picked up. And the officers in the battery clubbed together and paid a tailor in Bristol to make me a battle dress. And I claimed to be the only gunner who went to war in a tailor-made battle dress. I think I was unique in that one. Anyway, here we are. We turned around and we're coming back. And now we were in even more trouble because the refugees were still screaming down the road. And by now they'd been shot up from the air. They'd been bombed from the air. There were wrecked cars, dead people, dead cattle, dead horses. And to me, one of the worst sights was the cattle wandering about at the side of the road in the fields, unmilked, They'd just simply been turned loose by their farmers. And, you know, as a farm worker, it hurt me to see him like this. We retreated westward until we came to a village called St. Mommelin. St. Mommelin is a village just outside Saint-Omer. And there we hid in the tile works. I say hid because the Germans had complete air superiority, and if you were seen, then you got bombed. And while we were there, a small rifle party was made up. We only had a handful of rifles in the battery, used for sentries and guard duties. And this party was sent to a hill overlooking the canal at Saint-Omer, the bridge of which had been blown, and a reconnaissance party of Germans on motorcycle and sidecars appeared at the other side of the canal, found the bridge blown, and were looking there. And our men did get a chance to have one or two shots at them. I don't know whether they hurt them. So that we did actually get a little bit of action in the battery. The next thing was we left Saint-Mommelin going northward towards a town called Berg, which is about 4 miles inland from Dunkirk. And I remember going in we had the last bit we had to march very quietly because we were told the Germans were very close. And I remember going into Berg in the evening. We were billeted in the church, and I, great believer in comfort, I found myself a pillow up on a tomb, which had an open Bible at the end. I used as a pillow, and I had a good night's sleep there. And I woke up to find the priest celebrating Mass in the church, which has been odd. And then the next thing was to make for the beach. And I arrived at the battery went to a place called Bray Dune. Bray Dune is about 4 miles east of Dunkirk. It's very close to the Belgian border. It consists of nothing virtually, or did in those days, nothing virtually but sand dunes and a large red brick building, which was a hospital for children with TB. And there we were on the beach. And when we arrived, there were the streams of men queued out into the sea and the little boats taking the head of the queue out to destroyers and ships which were further out. And we just joined the party there. I spent 3 days there in the end.
What were conditions like on the beaches?
I've heard that we were bombed and shelled. We were certainly shelled. I was never bombed and I was never shot at in the beach. I had a lucky escape there. We'd not had much food for some days, and I had preserved one OXO cube. And I used this with a mess tin full of seawater to make myself a hot drink from a violin or something. It's anything you could think of. It's unimaginable, the rubbish that was lying about. And I got this fire going, and it was just nicely hotted up, and I was lying on the beach against one of the dunes, and there was a bang overhead, and the Frenchman who was lying next to me was killed, and unfortunately my mess tin was punctured with a bit of shrapnel or shell splinter, so I didn't get my hot drink. Conditions, looking back at it now, what amazes me is the discipline there. I saw absolutely no indiscipline whatsoever. And the men queued and got off. one interesting thing was a paddle steamer. I think it was probably the Golden Eagle, which used to run from London to Ramsgate before the war. She was out there loading troops, and she was bombed and set on fire. She's a paddle steamer, and they turned around and put her ashore, absolutely blazing, quite close to me. And as she got into the shallow water, the soldiers who'd been on board jumped off and promptly joined the next queue, ready to start again. This is the sort of discipline that I noticed there. I was lucky once, because after this shelling event, I thought I'd better take a bit of cover, and I worked my way up into the dunes, and I got a bit of shelter behind a bit of sand face, and something was dropped, a bomb probably, and I got buried in the sand. And it was just lucky that one of the other gunners from the battery, a chap called Ron Fortnum, knew just where I was, and he dug me out, because I'd been there today but for that. And quite sad, because I was quite helpless, pinned under this sand. Then it got rough, and the little boats which were ferrying men from the head of the queue to the ships out at sea had to stop because they were getting swamped. And I didn't like the look of this. I'd been there, as I say, 3 days. I got to the state when at night I used to suffer from hallucinations, and I quite thought that I was back on the farm, gone to see that the cows were all right at night. I was getting in a pretty bad state. But a fellow called Teddy Gardner and I, we said to each other, look, there's no future on this. We'd better try Dunkirk. Dunkirk, as I say, was 3 miles along there, and it was ablaze, and it was chaotic, the whole thing. And we walked. We said, well, let's walk to Dunkirk. At least there's nothing happening here. There may be something happening there. And as we approached Dunkirk, you must picture that on the left there was the land, the esplanade, rather like Brighton. And then in front of us, we're faced with this eastern mole, a gigantic granite protection of the harbour. And in the angle, there were literally hundreds of stretchers, all wounded soldiers, all strapped on the stretchers, just lying there. And I found an officer, and I said, is there any chance of a ship to get off? He said, yes, there is a ship. It's on the landward side of the mole, and you can get there, but you take a stretcher. And so Teddy Gardner and I took an end of a stretcher each and hauled this fellow up on the mole. And I think he was an officer from the Royal Engineers. And we walked along the mole. It was a bit hazardous because the Germans were then in the western part of Dunkirk, and they were shooting at the mole at a pretty good range. And then we had to cross a gap in the mole where a bomb had hit it on planks. And lo and behold, at the end, we found this little ship and lowered the stretcher down, and he was left on the deck, and we were made to go below. The ship was called the Roebuck, quite small, about 900 tons. She was used before the war to take produce from the Channel Islands to Weymouth. Got on there and had a cup of tea, and eventually we pushed off in broad daylight, sailed across the channel, absolutely unmolested. And this is quite incredible when you think the number of aircraft that were attacking ships all the time. And eventually arrived at Dover and disembarked there. I'd acquired a couple of rifles. I hated the thought of leaving anything behind, so although I went with no arm, I did come home with 2 rifles. And at the foot of the gangway, there was somebody taking our name and number and taking these 2 rifles off me. We then got in a train, and the next thing I knew, it was a strange coincidence. Having been at Wye, I knew the railway line from Dover to London. I lived in a village called Horsley, or mother and father lived in a village called Horsley, and Horsley is about 8 miles from Guildford. We got on this train and set off. We didn't stop anywhere, and I thought, well, there's a chance that this train might go through Guildford. I shall know, because if it gets to Red Hill, stops and reverses out, then it will most certainly go through Guildford. And I thought, well, here's a chance of letting my mother know that I'm home. So I wrote on a bit of paper, just, you know, Gunner Ems, please tell Mrs. Ems at East Horsley 117, her son's home, safe and well. Wrote on a bit of paper, and I thought, well, if we go through Guildford as we've gone through all the other stations non-stop, I'll hang out of the window with a bit of paper and a porter or somebody will grab it and mother will get the message. And we came out of the tunnel into Guildford Station at a fair speed, so I hung out and the man grabbed it. And, oh, gosh, you'll know. And we went about a mile, I suppose, and then backed into Guildford Station, into a bay, and ever so many women of all ages were there giving us cups of tea and coffee and cigarettes and buns and chocolate. And I thought, well, I'll make assurance double sure. And I said to one of these younger women, you know, would you mind phoning my mother at East Horsley 117 and tell her that I'm home? What name? Ems. And she looked at me and she said, well, either I'd been to school with her at Guildford High School in the early days, or she knew my sisters, who later went to Guildford High School. And she phoned up Mother, so Mother got 2 messages within 20 minutes to say I was home. The train carried on. The next thing I knew, I was in Leominster in Herefordshire, and we were unloaded at the station, and I was taken on a coal lorry to a greengrocer shop in the town. And there I collapsed for about 48 hours, and I was safely home. Next stage was we were paraded in a... You must understand that the train was full of all sorts of arms, not only gunners, infantry, RAF, everyone. Next stage in my memory, we go to a sort of park in Leominster, and we're sorted out according to our Army, Air Force, or whatever you happen to be. And our names and numbers were taken. The next move was I went somewhere on the North Wales coast, not far from Carnarvon, where 52nd Heavy Regiment was gathering itself up again. And I met the other survivors there, including my friend Bob Guns, with whom I'd walked to the Belgian border in those days.